Good evening, folks. This is The Weird Part. I am your host, Vincent Trewell, and tonight I have a very special guest, esoteric memoirist Stephanie Quick. You've probably heard me mention Stephanie at some point in this podcast, and we're very glad to have her on tonight. Please, welcome, Stephanie.
Hi, everyone. I'm excited tonight because we're going to be talking about probably, well, you may want to call it my own white whale, the E. Clambis Vitis Fraternal Secret Organization.
Yes, and it has been a fascinating... Stephanie and I have been doing a research project for this episode, and we've found some real rabbit holes and some very strange rabbits, okay? It's a twisted and confusing outfit, and I don't think either one of us is completely sure what we're dealing with.
No.
But we've certainly found some, we found more questions than answers, but there's some very interesting questions. I guess we should start. This is going to be fairly obscure for almost everybody, including myself. It was obscure when I started looking at it. E. Clampis Vitis, aka the Clampers, are a fraternal order somewhat along the lines of the Elks Club, the Moose Lodge, that sort of thing, at least apparently at a superficial level. What would you, how would you go a little further to describe them, Stephanie?
Well, let's see. I wrote a quote down here. My notes are going to be terrible because you said this is a very obscure organization, partly because they deliberately set out to be obscure. E. Clampis Vitis, no one really knows what it means because it's kind of dog Latin and they kind of made it up. But their motto is in Latin, credo qua absurdum, which is also not quite precise, but it means I believe it because it is absurd. So
yes,
they are concerned with nowadays, as you said, it's a fraternal organization. It's kind of secret, kind of not. It's by invitation only. It is all male. Their two main focuses are historical preservation in the U.S. West. So they have a bunch of different chapters, I think around 40 or 50. Through California, Colorado, Nevada, you know, the Pacific Northwest, and everything. And so they'll put up historical plaques. But I'm going to read from, okay, this is the Billy Holcomb ECV chapter, which is down in Southern California. So I'm reading from their website. They're a fun-loving, irreverent group dedicated to the preservation and documentation of the history of the West, including Native Americans, early settlers, the Gold Rush, and early 20th century memoir. They have 46 chapters and 6 outposts in 10 Western states. They work with private landowners, state agencies, museums, the Bureau of Land Management, Chambers of Commerce, historical societies, and others as available to research, verify, and disseminate historical facts relating to the places, events, and people that built these Western United States. Works include, quote, major and well-known histories, for example, the Patton Training Center, encompassing large parts of California and Arizona deserts, settlements in Panamint and Death Valleys, White Earp's former home in San Bernardino, the Mojave and Old Spanish Trails, and other well-documented sites and events. Okay, all this sounds pretty normal so far.
Yes.
Works also include lesser-known snippets of historical significance, i.e. the speed of light experiments performed in the late 1920s by Dr. Alan Michelson near Riverside, Dr. June McCarroll, who is credited with the idea of divided highways near Indio in 1917, and supposed UFO landing sites near Landers. So this
yes.
is how I came across them. They put up these plaques. They raise money. Now, this is kind of the modern version of it. They'll have big meetups and shindigs, and apparently they're well known for drinking. It's often called a drinking society with a historical problem.
Yes,
One
yes.
of the ways that they put it. And then they have these big things where they raise money so that then they can research and go through the approval process and everything, designing these historical plaques. So when I was young, my family goes back in California quite a ways, in Fresno and the foothills south of Yosemite. And so I was born in 1962. And so our parents would take us camping a lot all over the state of California when we were growing up. And my mom, especially, but both my mom and dad were both very interested in history. So, for example, one summer we had a week's camping, and my dad's birthday present to my mom was that we would stop at every single historical marker, which was like the greatest present I think anyone has given to anyone else.
No, honestly, that sounds perfect for the right couple.
But for the right, I mean, you know, they have since divorced, and dad has married another, my bonus mom, Doris, also an amazing woman. But yeah, I think that's, you know, when I think about like the blowout, incredible birthday present, that's like up there. If anything I've ever heard of, mom loved it. So we went to all these historical markers. And as you know, a lot of them are, you know, kind of chamber of commerce-y, state and national parks-y. So it's all very dealing with, you know, battles and important people who had a lot of money and all this type of stuff.
Yes.
But when so we'd see a lot of those, but then we always looked forward to the E. Clampus Vitus plaques, because mom and dad could tell us nothing about E. Clampus Vitus, and then they would have these fascinating things, like this one was put up actually on my mom's birthday in 1996 in Downeyville, which is an old gold rush era town from the 1849-1850 gold rush in California, when you had a huge influx of miners and a huge economic boom in California. So this, I wouldn't have seen this particular plaque, but this is very much along the lines of the what attracts you to these E. Clampus Vitus plaques. This was in memory of Juanita, the Spanish woman, because at this time, let's see, California had just entered the United States as a free state, and it had previously been under Spanish colonization and then part of the Republic of Mexico. Okay, the Spanish woman, also known as Josefa, was hung off the Jersey Bridge July 5th, 1851, a short distance downstream from this spot, for the murder of Frederick Alexander Augustus Cannon. Cannon and his friends were celebrating Independence Day, and after closing most of the saloons, they passed Jose and Josefa's cabin. Now, they were living together. I don't believe they were married, but this is the man that she had chosen to be with. This guy Cannon, he broke the door down. However, history did not tell what happened the next. The next morning, he came back supposedly to apologize. An argument ensued, and Josefa stabbed Cannon fatally in the heart. A mob trial was held, and she was sentenced to death. Josefa climbed the scaffold without the least trepidation and placed the rope around her own neck. Her last words were, "I would do the same again if I was so provoked."
Wow.
Yeah.
So they put up a brass plaque for a lynching, is that essentially what happened? Wow.
Yeah, and this is the kind of the paradox, or the one of the sides of E. Clampus Vitus. They their first iteration, at least here in the West in California, was with the gold rush and amongst the miners. And there were people that came. There was kind of like the miners who worked, you know, trying to pan or, you know, blast out gold out of the mountains.
Oh, yes.
But there were also people who came in as merchants and to make money and start banks and all that type of stuff.
So which was often much more profitable than looking for gold.
Oh, yes. Yes. So you have the kind of more respectable veneer, and that would be people that would be like the Masons. The Odd Fellows were very big. Mom always looks for an Odd Fellows Lodge every town we go to. She's like, this is often the first building that they would build in any town would be the Odd Fellows Lodge, which is true.
If I just may interject, my grandfather was both a Mason and an Odd Fellow. Mm-hmm. And those things were huge back in the 40s and 50s.
Yes.
And before. But yes, they're still around, but not a shadow of their former selves, you might say.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yes, go ahead.
So you had these kind of more traditional fraternal orders. And they, you know, they'd be like vetting people. You couldn't just be like any regular slob. So the Clampers kind of arose became more popular as like the everyman's, the blue collar thing. They would wear like union suits, which were red, you know, the one piece underwear.
Oh, yes.
And then instead to kind of mock, you know, the Masons and these other fraternal organizations, and they'd get like tin cans and make little badges out of them and pin them on their union suits. And the initiations would be like basically a mockery of all the stuffiness. And they would basically take anyone that was, you know, like a reasonable person, as long as you were a man. And yes. I guess that the rumor is the big part of the initiation was that the initiate had to buy drinks for everyone.
Yes.
So they were constantly on the lookout for new initiates.
Yes, it was kind of and there is a real aspect where it's just a good time, bunch of guys that I got the impression from their various websites and stuff. The phrase that came to mind was bikers without motorcycles.
Yeah.
They just kind of like to have a good time, kind of rough around the edges. But, you know, that's one aspect, that we're just here to party and have a good time and, you know, fellowship. We're not stuffed shirts. We're down to earth people and just some guys drinking some beer, having a good time. And that's one aspect. But go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. And then had a little bit of the mutual aid aspect of a lot of these fraternities. They say they were here to take care of the widows and orphans, but especially the widows, because of course they have to be a bunch of horn dogs too. One of their flags that they would have back in the day, and they still do it, is like the flag we fight under, right? And they have like a hoop skirt. They would a hoop skirt and raise that up as their flag.
There's a lot of kind of, maybe from my grandfather's era, kind of sexual double entendres and, you know, kind of joking around type of, it reminds me very much of my grandfather's card club is what I kind of think of it.
You know,
that sort of a spirit.
Yeah. And with them coming out of the Gold Rush era, they ended up having a love and affection for prostitutes and sex workers. Because a lot of the first women who were in California, you know, at that time, if they weren't Mexican or indigenous women, they would be sex workers. And there was an interesting chapter. A lot of these chapters have, or some of them have, websites, and there's some interesting historical information and testimonials on these websites. But there is a chapter, and it includes Virginia City in Nevada, which was a silver mining town. And the chapter is named after Julia C. Bullitt, who was a noted Nevada prostitute. And they have a great article by someone named Johnny Gunn on their website. And it's very sympathetic towards her. She had came to the city at the beginning of the Gold Rush, and she was very civic minded. She was very heavily involved with and supportive of the firefighters, and she was made like an honorary member of one of the engine companies. They had a flu epidemic, and she was very active in nursing people and helping people get food and everything during that time. And she was also an accomplished seamstress. And so as the boom took hold, for economic boom from them doing all this silver mining, you started to have the same thing happen in California and these other instances. More high class, respectable, quote unquote, women coming in. And this was in the 1860s. And they started to have, like, you know, operas and those type of events. And so she would make gowns for the upper class woman as a seamstress and designer that they'd wear to these events. However, she was about 35 years old. And in 1867, she was found murdered.
Oh, wow.
Yes, which is pretty horrible. And the guy writing this article says that there's a lot of rumors about prostitutes in these type of situations, or madams, brothel owners being murdered for their money, but she really didn't have any money or jewels or anything saved up. She had actually more debts than assets. And they ended up, and it's interesting because this whole focus on her, it kind of shows how she, let's see, how you have these kind of assigned social statuses back then, and of course today as well. People that are less dead, right?
Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely.
You know, if you are thought to be a gang member or a drug dealer or a sex worker, your murder is going to be thought to be less pressing in many jurisdictions. There's a horrible problem with missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, especially up in Canada.
Absolutely.
So this is an ongoing thing that is interesting in some of these chapters and some of these plaques and stuff that they choose to focus on these issues. This is like the same thing with Josepha, where she got lynched because she dared to stand up to this white guy raping her, right?
Yes, that's certainly exactly what it sounded like. Yes.
Yeah. But anyway, so, and it's interesting here because the issues of inequity in society go even further, because there was a French miner who was found with some of her patterns, some of her sewing patterns. And I don't know, this detail just touches me because I've sewn and sewn a lot of clothing over my life. So I don't know, just a similarity there. And they tried him for her murder, found him guilty, and hanged him. However, he had basically no English. So there's a lot of questions about, did he really do it? Was he competent to participate in his own defense, because he couldn't even understand the language?
Yes. Being tried in French would be quite, you know, quite a stumbling block.
Yeah. So it's one of those, it shows that even though they have this reputation as being, you know, a bunch of kind of randy drunk guys who are disreputable and rowdy, and I think that, you know, there you will find people that will say that yes, they are, but then you have these other people who are like very dedicated historians and interested at looking at society, not just like buying the line.
So
we were talking about, for example, it seems to have like echoes of Discordianism in it.
Absolutely. That,
or, yeah.
You hear over and over, we're just a bunch of happy-go-lucky, hard-drinking fellows who also talk history. Mm-hmm. But you're told over and over, don't take any of this seriously. It's all a big joke. Nothing mm-hmm. here, we're irreverent. Nothing here is to be taken seriously. But then when you look at some of the things that they've participated in over decades, and some of the real historical, I say real in the sense of actual things they've done, not that those things are true, but okay, there seems to be a real tendency that they're kind of pushing an agenda quietly, but very, very clearly, if you look at it, that mm-hmm. they're pushing a certain narrative, and that they're willing to go to ridiculous lengths to promote something that, if it's all a big joke, I mean, who takes those kind of risks and spends that kind of time and effort and money? You know, there's a specific one that we're going to get to, but mm-hmm. even before the big ones, well, if we could go back just a little bit, their own alleged, their self-described history, which is ridiculous, okay? Yep. It can't possibly be true.
It's farcical.
Yes, it comes from the East Coast. in, I believe, Virginia, where they supposedly had their first chapter and their first, leadership, their first lodge.
Noble
And
grand humbug.
yes. But supposedly that was commissioned by emissaries from the Emperor of China. Well, okay, to be blunt, there's no way in hell that any Emperor of China sent emissaries to start this fraternal order in Virginia. That did not happen. Okay, that 100% did not happen. And that's their described history. It's like that all the way through. There's always these ridiculous statements that everybody knows couldn't possibly be true. And then they sweep all sorts of famous people in as having been clampers back in time, from George Washington and basically everybody
Adam.
important.
Adam.
Yes,
He was the original clam patriarch. They also have all these corny names for everything.
Which is intentionally, it's funny, and it's mocking the Masons a lot. It's
Yes.
constantly mocking the Masons. But when you look past that, and well, just to briefly touch on the Discordians were doing this in the 50s and 60s, where they were, hey, it's a big joke, we're pranking the squares. They'd do stuff like send message, like letters to members, high-ranking members of the John Birch Society, and tell them that other members were really in the Illuminati. And it was, we're just, messing with people. But then people who were in that the Discordians, such as Kelly Thornley, end up being tangentially involved with the assassination of President Kennedy. And it gets real, real quick, and then nobody believes what they have to say because everything's been a big joke up to this point. And it gets really complicated. What was a joke and what was flying under the radar?
Yes, no, I completely agree. And I was now there were, and this is another thing. So I was chatting with David Metcalf about this because the original the first bits that we could see about like the historical Eclampus Vitus Society is like in the mid 1840s, and it's like in West Virginia. Supposedly, this guy named Ephraim B was a inn and stable owner in, now it's called West Union, West Virginia. And this is, the guy that supposedly got the commission from Caleb Cushing, who was the ambassador to China. And you can still see a lot of these fables that are set up about how this started. And a lot of it is very racist and playing on kind of tropes of exotic Asian ideas and stuff, and people just messing around. But so you have
That's
this.
something that people used to do, and to some extent still do today,
Oh,
which
yeah.
is have your mystic ideas come from someplace far away over there, and it gives it
Exactly.
more gravitas. It gives it taken more seriously if it's Tibetan or if it's, Indian than if it came from some guy in Illinois,
Yeah, it's kind of like if you it helps you to suspend your disbelief than if it was, this guy down the road that who
Yes,
came up with this idea,
exactly.
right?
It has to
But
be as far away and little known as possible.
yes,
I was
but
just
I
briefly, go ahead.
oh, so I was so I was asking Metcalf about this place in Georgia, Dahlonega, Georgia, which supposedly had some Eclampus Vitus activity in the 1840s up there. Actually, that was a gold rush town as well. So you see the ongoing connection with minings. And he said that he hadn't seen anything. He hadn't heard any rumors. He said it was still owned by like certain families that have been there for a long time. And he let slip that mostly they do a lot of growing apples. They have a lot of apple orchards there. And I was thinking, so I'm thinking about this and I think, oh, wait, golden apples, golden apples, golden apple,
That
Eris Discordian. And I was cracking up because this is
is
actually,
wild.
isn't that funny that you have that thing? And I don't know that there's a connection you could make with people involved with Eclampus who then went on to be involved in founding Discordianism. But I make the point that, you know, I've never been involved with anyone in Eclampus Vitus that I know of, but they leave these objects through the landscape. And as you can tell from like the one that I read, the plaque, they have a very certain kind of viewpoint about history and telling stories about what has happened in certain areas and kind of knitting stories and viewpoints into the landscape.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So you don't have it. So just by being in that landscape, you can get exposed to these ideas, if that makes sense.
Oh, yes, it totally does. And that's, to just be very blunt, that's the thread that runs through this, is that their narrative is really targeted and specific. Mm-hmm. And it's not the general history of stuff that happened in the American West. It's very much a narrative of the British and later Anglo-Americans, specifically, yep. You know, British Americans. I would say white, but they're not. It's even more narrow than that, because they don't want it to be the Spanish narrative.
Exactly.
Or the French narrative, or the Russian narrative. They want it to be the Anglo narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And that the Anglo people built the West and are enmeshed in its history and have every claim to California and the rest of the West.
Yep.
And that's what is the ongoing thread that never gets old with them. And just to mention two things very briefly, their alleged founder, I noticed that they carefully put him being on the right side of the Civil War.
Oh, yes, very much so.
That he was a big figure in the Underground Railroad, mm-hmm. and that they'd hold clamper meetings to disguise the movement of escaping slaves, and
yes.
that they were definitely not Confederates.
Yes.
Whether that might be true or not, if you were writing it after the Civil War was well over and you wanted to give yourself a good history, that's the side you'd put yourself on, you know? And they do a lot of that, you know, where they portray themselves as the good guys, whether there's any historical truth to that at all, you know?
Yes. And well, and it's interesting too, because there is, like you say, because the other thing about them aligning themselves with the Union in the Civil War is that California came into the Union in 1850 as a free state, right?
Yes.
Although it wasn't actually, because the last people to be emancipated from slavery in the United States were the indigenous peoples of California.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow. That is.
Yeah.
We've learned something here today. Well, I've learned something here today. I did not realize that.
I only knew it because my mom's people go back to the Chukchansi tribe, which is a Yokut tribe in the foothills of California. So I got kind of a certain aspect of hidden history growing up, even though, you know, mom's not an enrolled tribal member or anything, when we got bought out of our land rights in 1972, when they had a big kind of forced buyout of land rights.
There's a lot of tribal politics that is ongoing to the current day. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah. So it's interesting to me that kind of echoes that aspect of California history, because that was a big deal, obviously.
Oh, yes. So they were only freed by the passage of the 13th Amendment?
The people in California, I want to say that it was like sometime in the late 1870s or early 1880s. I'm not sure exactly how they.
I'm got not there. Trying to put you on the spot on
it's mid-19th
century history quiz.
I should know, but it's one of those things that is really as hard to track to run down. When Barbara Boxer was a senator here from California, she had a great website with on her government website, she had a lot of this
Yes.
information on there, but then now she's not there anymore. So that was where I used to go because I'm terrible. I used to be really good at dates, and then I got Lyme disease, and
Oh man.
my brain is different.
No, that's a very serious thing. Yes. Wow.
But anyway, so yeah, so like you say, there's this kind of Anglo narrative that they're pushing, and it kind of ignores certain aspects of racial politics here
Oh
in
yes. I mean, they have
California.
a very clear agenda there, and it promotes, and want to say it the right way. But it justifies manifest destiny is really what it does. It's like trying to kind of write a alternative history, and by alternative mean didn't really happen. History where the Anglo-Americans aren't conquering other peoples or taking their land, but taking back land that was already theirs, which sounds a lot better, you know? And they try to establish that even when there's no actual basis for that whatsoever.
Okay, we should just come out with it. We're going to talk about the Drake's Plate hoax.
Yes, absolutely. This is the best piece of evidence, but not the only one. Okay, there are many, but this is a really fascinating one. So please go ahead.
Oh God, let me tell you, this is something that I have known about and learned about through many years growing up here. Because I was born in Fresno, but then I have lived most of my life in like the East Bay of San Francisco, like Oakland, Berkeley, Cache Valley, and then now I'm up in Napa, and so I've just always been around this area where all this went down. I even went to Berkeley. My mom and dad both worked for Berkeley, like UC Berkeley, and
That must have been a fascinating childhood. I'm just butting in, but yeah.
we were really lucky. Our parents spent a lot of time with us and did a lot of enriching activities with that. There was a lot. You could go down to Telegraph Avenue, the Museum of Paleontology, the Museum, the De Young and Asian Art Museum in San Francisco, and the Oakland Museum, and all type of concerts. Opera. We were in youth orchestras. There was like experimental performances. I mean, and our parents really helped us experience all of that. So we're very, very fortunate. And there's a lot of wild, woolly people about.
That's what's kind of talking about the Berkeley vibe that, I do not know firsthand, but that just seems like a fascinating place to grow up.
It was a lot of fun. You definitely don't think that you're like the weirdest person. You don't think that you're the smartest person. I mean, but it's a lot of fun. There's just like a lot going on. But anyway, so I have been wanting to talk about Eclampus Vitus for a long time and the Drake's hoax because, like you say, it's like this way where certain facts and agendas about history get kind of perpetrated onto the landscape and the kind of general idea sphere, and everyone starts accepting it, and then it's still accepting even though it's like based on bullshit.
Yes, it's complete bullshit, made up things that are not real. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so let me try and explain this to you because it was a hoax that was perpetrated, and then it's been like what about, let's see, 30, 40 years of historians trying to figure out exactly how the hoax went down and who was involved, and it's still very contrary. They can't even figure out how the hoax got done. So it's just like it's maddening. But here are the basic timeline I'm going to try and take people through. Okay, so back in the day, which would, let's see, be like about 1579 AD, there was this guy, Sir Francis Drake, who was English, and he was part of Britain, and at the behest of Queen Elizabeth I, he had taken his ship, the Golden Hind, and about 80 dudes, and they were circumnavigating the globe, right?
Yes, yes.
And this is the whole idea of Britain becoming starting to get really into being a colonial power and trying to navigate the globe, figure out what is out there, and let's claim as much as we can for the glory of England, the glory of the Virgin Queen, and plunder and kneecap the Spanish, because the Spanish were trying to do the same thing.
Absolutely, yes. And
so
John Deese is her, the
yep.
well-known magician wizard guy, is probably the most well-known, really, one of the most, is her personal intelligence officer and also personal magician. But I don't want to deviate too far. But yes, there's a major push by Britain to become the sea power and to become this world power through its navy. But go ahead.
Yeah. So it was like an incredibly exciting and very creative time. Like you said, John Dee, this is when Shakespeare was writing and stuff. So there's just an incredible ferment. Okay. So they are come down across the Atlantic, come down South America, and they start coming back up, and they get to the west coast of North America. And at some point, they haul off because the ship needed some type of repairs, and they repaired the ship, and then they had a brass plate, and they wrote on it, basically, we're claiming this land of New Albion for Queen Elizabeth, blah, 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 and we've communicated this with the native peoples of the area, God Save the Queen, or whatever, I forget the exact language, you can look it up if you're interested. And they had a sixpence that they nailed to the plaque so it would have a likeness of the queen on it to make it official, and nailed it to a tree. Now, how would we know this? Well, they got back.
Just to interrupt. Do you actually want me to read it? Because I have it here.
If you want, yeah.
Now, this is what was on the plate.
Mm-hmm.
Be it known unto all men by these presents. 17, this is, I guess this is June 17, 1579. By the grace of God, in the name of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth of England and her successors forever, I take possession of this kingdom, whose king and people freely resign their right and title to the whole land into Her Majesty's keeping, now named by me, and to be known to all men as Nova Albion, G. Francis Drake.
Yeah. So that is the famous plate. Now, how would we know about this? Well, one of the guys that was on this voyage wrote up his experiences afterwards, and they had these notes, and it was published. And so it has come down to us. Okay.
Yes. And so, I mean, the content there is, yeah, we've talked to the Indians, and they totally surrender all the rights for some reason. Yeah. And, you know, it's cool. They gave it to us.
Yeah.
So, I mean, at its face, that seems like very suspicious, but go ahead.
Yeah. But I mean, it's in line with what these type of explorers of the age would do. That was kind of like their modus operandi for approaching these situations. So let's see. So why would anyone care about this? Okay. Well, it shows that the England in let's say Euro political sphere would have claim to that land, right?
Yes. Oh, it's a very British claim. From
yes.
pre-1600, yes.
Yes, and so this would be like very interesting, because it would be prior to Jamestown and, you know, other early settlements on the east coast of the continent. So
indeed.
So it's historically, and if you're looking at it from that kind of legal, diplomatic, treaty type, I guess, claims, you could use this to make an argument that, right, as we're
Oh,
talking
yes,
about. Okay.
exactly. It's a title claim, you might say.
Thank you. Now, when did this become an issue again in America? Okay. I would like to introduce a person called Professor Bolton, who is a white dude who was originally interested in kind of like Texas and the whole history of he was a historian, trained as a historian, and he was interested in Texas and the history of the Spanish and American kind of border and frontier, which is interesting. And this was one of his big pushes as a historian. He became incredibly prominent, incredibly influential, had a number of huge students, and they call the Bolton School or Boltonism, which is the idea that you should look at the history of like the entire continent or region of North America, as opposed to just looking at the history of America, of like the United States in isolation. And
Wow.
when you, yeah, I
I
was,
mean, that's a very different approach than we usually take, yes.
yeah, and so the, and this is like a big step forward. He was studying, became influential, and then in 1911, he became a professor of history at UC Berkeley, and he stayed there until 1944, and was he like supervised? I think he has like a world record for supervising the most PhD theses, like over 300.
Wow.
Yes, he's incredibly influential. Historian, wrote a
So
lot.
he was not just a professor, but he's
No.
a major figure in the field of academic history.
Oh yeah, he's like a super big deal. He founded as well the Bancroft Library, which is a big history library at UC Berkeley. It's like one of the premier history libraries in the world. Bolton, I think he at between 10 or 11 international universities gave him advanced degrees, honorary degrees. I mean, he was incredibly prominent and prestigious guy. So he, for whatever reason, was really into this whole idea of Drake's Plate and reading about it, because he had an idea that it had been deposited in Point Reyes, which is east of Berkeley and north of San Francisco. It's the area of land called Point Reyes. It's in Marin County, just north of the Golden Gate. And in like the 1870s or something, there's a guy who was a geographer, and he had put it in his mind, or figured out that he thought that there was this one particular little bay that he thought was Drake's Bay, and he petitioned a local area to get it named Drake's Bay, and it's still called Drake's Bay to this day. If you want, you can look it up on a map. It's
Interesting.
yes, I mean, it's great. It's in part of a Point Reyes, which is a national park, national, I forget the exact name for it, but it's a gorgeous area, and you can go there. It's incredibly beautiful. I've been there many, many, many times over my life, and it has incredible natural beauty, history, and including this bay that has been thought of as Drake's Bay for I guess hundreds of years now. So Bolton was really into the idea that this is Drake's Bay, and he was always telling his students and anyone who would listen, keep an eye out for this plate, because it'll prove that Drake was there. Now, there were a couple, and it's interesting because there were a couple of women who were like historians or anthropologists. One was Zelia Nuttall. And she was lived from 1857 to 1933, I think. And she was an anthropologist, and she studied, I think her mom was from Mexico, and she studied Mexican archaeology and anthropology, very learned as well. She became friends with Phoebe Hearst, who was the woman who started the School of Anthropology at UC Berkeley, which is where I studied anthropology, in the Phoebe Hearst building. and right across from Cafe Rouen. And that is Hearst of William Hearst, the newspaper
I
magnate.
was going to ask, that's
Yeah.
one of the Hearsts. Like,
Oh, yes. Like Patty Hearst,
I was going
William
to bring that
Hearst,
up too. Yes. Who had a much
Rosebud,
worse
that
experience at
Hearst.
Berkeley, but yes.
Yes. Hearst Castle. Yes. So Phoebe Hearst, was of that family. I think I want to say it was William Hearst's wife. Don't quote me on that. But anyway, yeah. So she was a big philanthropist, and she ended up founding the School of Anthropology at UC Berkeley. And Zelia Nuttall was one of her people that she worked with, like Phoebe Hearst was like her benefactress. But Zelia had been studying this, and she thought that that Drake had actually pulled in farther up in the Pacific Northwest for various reasons. But Bolton didn't
Like
like this
maybe
idea.
around more around Seattle or even British Columbia.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bolton really didn't like this, and he kind of undercut Zelia Nuttall and was able to get kind of capture the narrative back for his idea that Drake had been here in California. So that was around 1917. Now
Okay,
then
if I
it
may just interject, and it would be important that the British Empire placed its claim in Southern California rather than near Canada. That makes a big
Yeah, whereas it's
geopolitical
actually,
difference.
yeah, actually it's Northern California, but yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
You want it in
Drake's
California,
Bay.
you don't want it up there.
Exactly, yes. Drake's Bay is like right north of the Golden Gate Bridge. So it's like a right north of San Francisco.
Okay.
Yeah. And I was almost just gonna say, and it's on the coast, believe it or not, the bay is near all the big water.
Yes.
Everyone's going to feel like very enlightened now that I pointed that out for them.
Yes.
Oh, no.
No, that makes complete sense. And it would be very geopolitically important to be in California rather than
Yes.
be in somewhere that's kind of like Canada.
Well, yes. And then the other thing with Bolton is that, you know, th then this is like right near, if you're going to drive from UC Berkeley to Drake's Bay, it's maybe a couple hours. So it's like very close. That's in California time. That's
Yeah, that's
very close.
California close. Yes.
It's
Yes.
California. Actually, let's see. It might be an hour and a half, but yeah, it's very close there. So it's just like if you are at Berkeley and you start heading out towards the ocean, well, then actually that would all be on water. So you just my image is making no sense because you would be like driving right into the bay. Scratch that. Okay. Then in 1936, this other woman who was a historian, Ava, it says Ava Bolton. I think I might have misrepresented her name there, but she was a historian, and she was also placing Drake in the Pacific Northwest. And so there was a lot more pressure again on this whole narrative of Drake's Bay being in Point Reyes and just north of San Francisco.
Is she maybe Taylor?
I think you might be right.
I think
I think I
that's
wrote that incorrectly.
no, it's really easy to do. I'm just digging through my notes here.
I know this is just.
Let's see. Nuttall and Taylor's evidence.
Yeah, Taylor. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the other female anthropologist that's looking into this. But
Yeah.
go ahead, please.
In 1936. So what would be something that would be really great that you could find that would put all this argument to rest?
Yes, obviously, if the plates itself could be somehow happened upon, that'd be great.
Yes. And what do you know?
Yes.
So in I think 1936, there comes to Bolton's attention this plate, and it has that writing on it. It's brass, it looks old-timey. It has I don't know if it has a sixpence on there. I think it has a hole where the sixpence could have been. And it was apparently found. Well, actually, it looks like it was found by the guy that gave it to Bolton near San Quentin. Yes, that's San Quentin, the prison, which is also quite near here. Some guy had been out there driving and had, I think that he had flat tire or engine trouble, pulled off to the side of the road and had to answer the call of nature. And as he was looking around for some leaves to clean up with, he happened to find this plaque. Now, San Quentin, again, is, I don't know, these days I looked at it on Google Maps, like an hour and 20 minutes drive from San Quentin to Drake's Bay, but it's still pretty close. And of course, with this narrative that we have about how it got found, you have more of this clamperitis to it, right? Because the
Yes.
guy's taking a shit, right?
Yes.
And then the other
I
thing
would have
is,
lied about that. No, aliens gave it to me or something. I'm not telling them
really,
that.
and here's the kicker. The last thing that you would want to do, that you would ever risk doing in the landscape of California, is using leaves to wipe yourself with, because we have poison oak all over the place here.
Yes, my
And it's a lot
brief
worse
time
than
in
poison.
California, that seems like a worst case scenario, man.
It's incredibly risky. You can't, I mean, my mom has a very good friend, and her dad was a Boy Scout when they were young. And the Boy Scouts said, oh, just go and get gather wood for a fire. And they just got like sticks and twigs and everything. And they all these little kids ended up in the hospital
Oh,
because they had
man.
poison oak in the lung, because they'd had some just sticks in. So this stuff, I mean, you know, you could have like just a stray stick in there and you'd be in misery for weeks.
Oh
So
man.
yeah, so the whole story is sounding suspicious. Also, it's like at San Quentin, which is like nothing like what Drake described getting to. So then someone else comes on the scene and says, oh, actually, we found it at Drake's Bay. And then I had it in my car. And then I thought I was going to use it for something, but then I didn't need it. So I just like threw it out of the car at San Quentin. And then, so all of
Which
this is
all just sounds ridiculous, you know?
super likely. Okay. But Bolton was this big, a very, incredibly prominent historian, and he was like super stoked to push this plate and the story behind it and the way that it lends this legitimacy to Drake landing in California in 1579. So he decided to kind of certify it as a historian, and the people, a couple of people around him were kind of saying, eh, it doesn't quite look right, but he got real hot and raised all this money, like $3,500. This is like in mid 1930s, to
Where you can buy
purchase
a
this
house for
thing.
that, yeah.
Yeah. And then put it on display in the Bancroft Library, which he was just starting. And so, you know, have this incredible historical item there where people could come and see it. And it really solidified the idea of Drake showing up and being part of this. And interestingly enough, I didn't really see this addressed in any of the articles about it, but of course, I have been many times to the Renaissance Fair. A lot of people enjoy them.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Go ahead.
And it started down in Southern California in like around 1966 or 65. That was like the very first one. But then within a year or two, they started having one in the fall, and it was up here in China Beach, which is just right close to San Quentin and Drake's Bay. And of course, this is a living history project where you have a recreation of Elizabethan England, right? So you have Queen Elizabeth and her court, and they always have an actor playing Sir Francis Drake walking around. And of course, this is really cool because why? Because Sir Francis Drake, he was just, you know, an hour from here is when he landed at Drake's Bay. So you see how
it builds, it's woven, it gets woven into the tapestry of pop culture. And pop culture sounds like I'm diminishing it, but the way people think about the world, it becomes part of our worldview.
And it's a, I mean, and the thing is, I mean, the Renaissance Fair, I mean, still some of them are still big sticklers about it, but especially back then, it was like a living history thing, right? You have people, actually, I was one of those people making whole entire costumes by stitching by hand. Oh, with wow. The embroidery and everything. Actually, I made a suit for my husband, and one of the slops on there, or the pants of his suit, have a design based on a cloak that was worn by Sir Francis Drake. It has like moon and stars. I kind of abstracted that design on the slops, and it's all hand stitching in metallic thread. But anyway, so there's a lot of emphasis on not just being a fantasy thing. You know, nowadays you have a lot of steampunk and stuff, which is kind of like this alternative history and LARPing. But especially back then, it was a lot of people recreating history as best they could. So I think it had more of a gravitas or a feeling of authenticity to it when you go to the Ren Fair and then you see, oh yeah, these are all based on actual historical people, right?
Oh, that's a very different take than I've ever experienced, which was what I've been involved with was much more Lord of the Rings. And, you know, we're not pretending that this is a time that ever really happened. We're just kind of like King Arthur more than like Queen Elizabeth I. Okay. Quite a difference there, you know. But yeah, that really is a different way of looking at it. And
yeah, back then it was a living history project.
Wow. Yeah. And I'm just going to ask you, I don't expect an answer because I didn't prep you for this question at all. But does that have anything to do with the Society for Creative Anachronism?
Well, SCA came out of Berkeley, like literally town of Berkeley. They ended up, the first SCA May Day festival was in the mid 60s, and they ended it up by like having a parade down Telegraph Avenue. Wow. Singing Green Sleeves. So again, there you see like the Anglo focus of it.
And, oh, yes.
And the emphasis on history. And yeah, it came out of like this, that basically the same place and the same time that you have all these people going apeshit for this stuff.
Yes. And laying down a foundation of, we're doing these rites that were done in the British Isles, but we're doing them here in California, and they belong here.
And it's right across, you know, on a clear day, if you go up on Berkeley, you can look over to the Golden Gate, which is just right by Drake's Bay.
Yes,
you can't see yes, Drake's indeed. Bay from Berkeley. But it's just all part of knitting these events and ideas and histories into the landscape.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Which is very, and, you know, if you have any public speaking coaching or theory under your belt, right? You know that if you can get people physically participating in and interacting with your narrative, whatever it is, it's much more impactful. I hate that word, but you're going to remember, people are going to remember it.
Yes, absolutely. That's marketing. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So how was it that Bolton happened to be such a lucky guy that they found this plaque?
Indeed.
and on top of it, the thing is if you look at the landscape over there, I mean, one of the reasons why the Highway 1, which is on the coast of California, right the edge of the water there, is a world renowned for being incredibly beautiful and dramatic, is because, you know, like, we're right on the edge of the Pacific crust there, and it's a very geologically active area. So you have faulting, you have earth lifting up, you have a lot of cliffs that are eroding all the time. So the idea that this thing would just be kind of like hanging around for like, you know, 500 years or 400 years, I guess.
Really tests the imagination, doesn't it? Yes.
It's kind of, it would be kind of an interesting situation given the lay of the land, as it were, and the many changes that it goes through. Okay. So now we had left our clampers in the gold mines, and they had been continuing on with having their parades and their enclampments, and then doing some history stuff for and all their initiations and stuff for many years. But things had really petered out, and by the time that World War One came around, things were pretty much in the doldrums as far as Eclampus Vitus. Things had pretty much ceased to be going on. But of course, there continued to be various historians and eccentrics who were interested in this stuff. There was a guy called Carl Irving Wheat. And in the early 1930s, supposedly, he decided that he was interested in reviving the clampers. And he got in touch with a guy, Alan Moore, who was really old. He lived to be like a 90 or 95. And he had been a clamper back in the day. And so
I'm sorry to interrupt, but just for our listeners, this is not the Alan Moore, who's a British magician. That's and those comic books. Totally different person, happened to have the same name. Please continue.
No, well, that's actually an excellent point.
If you've seen a picture of Alan Moore, I might need to make that distinction. You know,
it's true.
Go ahead.
So he spoke to Carl Wheat and told him about all the various structures and processes and traditions and rituals and initiation stuff of the clampers, so they could get this ball rolling again. Carl Wheat, again, was he died in 1906. He was pretty old. He was an incredibly accomplished person. He worked for the FCC. He, I believe, was a lawyer. He worked for the government in World War II. He was a director of the California Historical Society at one point. He was on the advisory board for the National Park System. He was a clamper. And interestingly enough, at one point, he was president of the Friends of the Bancroft Library, which was Bolton's big project.
And if I may, there you see kind of the two sides of the clampers.
Yep.
That's, you have the blue collar miners, we're not as snooty as the Masons type of thing. And then you have people that are incredibly connected like that, who and are the upper crust, who know people who know people, who make real decisions that affect what gets put in the library, what gets put in the museum, what courses get emphasized and de-emphasized, and who have a lot of influence. And those are two very different things.
I mean, you want to know how much influence Carl Wheat took sick for his final illness, his final fatal illness. He was at the Bohemian Grove property up on Russian River.
Indeed. Well, of course connected. He was. That's perfect. Yes, that kind of thing. Yes. Somebody who knows people that know people. Yes.
Yeah. But the interesting thing about this Drake's hoax is Carl Wheat is never mentioned as having anything to do with it at all, even though he was involved with the Bancroft Library and all this stuff.
Yeah, somehow his name was left off of it, indeed.
Somehow he managed to avoid that. Okay, so everyone is excited about this Drake's Plate and how it, as you say, knits the whole, justifies the whole idea of the Anglo influence in California. And then it's going to come up, I guess it was like 1977. They thought, wow, this is cool. Because in 2 years, it's going to be the 400th anniversary of Drake visiting Drake's Bay here. So We have all these great facilities here in Berkeley, and so we can really study this plate and find out more about it and justify it, right?
And that's probably the last thing some people wanted is let's turn some real, CSI investigation on this object. No. But that's what happened. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. Well, Bolton had died by then. And all these people that, as you will see, are the main suspects, I think, had all died pretty much by then. They took it up to like Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory and started checking it out. And hey, what do you know? This thing was made in like 20th century manufacture of brass. And it did not have, the signs of manufacture back in the day, had signs of modern manufacture. The patina on it, which a lot of people have been pointing out, they're like, how come this looks so fresh? They're like, oh, yes. It must be the California climate has something special to it. Okay.
I mean, it's really not difficult to tell the difference between brass from 1900 and brass from 1600. They're very different. And
yes.
Yeah. It fell apart pretty quick. Would that be correct?
Yes. As soon as they started looking at it. And as it turned out, they had even, the people who had made it had even used like invisible paint that would fluoresce under black lights. And on the back of it, they had written ECV for Eclampus vitus. So you put the black light on, it's like, oh.
So they literally tagged their work. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes. Very nice. Okay. So they realized that this was a hoax. But still, there's the whole idea of, well, who did it? Why did they do it? What was their purpose? Who was it directed at? Who was involved? Okay. You would think that this would be more straightforward, but as it happened, this is the thing. There's kind of like two main competing narratives for who was hoaxed it and what was the motivation. The first one came out in about 2003. You had like four historians who had been looking into this for about 11 years. Wow. And they finally came up with a narrative, which was basically it was a prank that got out of hand. Now, I have to say here, my favorite conspiracy theory of all time is the idea that Stevie Wonder is not actually blind. It was just a prank that got out of hand.
I'm going to have to push back a little bit. If by favorite you mean like most interesting, most rather than the one I believe, yeah, exactly, it's completely ridiculous. Oh my god! But
so I was kind of tickled to see that these guys had decided to go with that narrative. They had published an article in the journal California History where they talk about their thing, and then in 2003. This is when they came out with this theory. UC Berkeley made a whole press release about this, the Drake's Plate hoax. Okay, so they say that there are these major players are G. Ezra Dane, who's a prominent member of Eclampus Vitus, and also the California Historical Society. He, according to these people, instigated the hoax. Next, George Haviland Barron, who is curator of California history at the DeYoung Museum in San Francisco until 1933, and a leading member of the California Historical Society, who designed the fake plate. The DeYoung Museum is like a premier museum of art and Asian art internationally. If you ever get a chance to visit, it's incredible. But yeah, a very prominent person. George C. Clark was an inventor, art critic, appraiser, and friend of Barron's, and he engraved the plate. So just kind of a guy. Lorenz Knoll, an art dealer and restorer, and Western artifact dealer Albert Dressler. They are believed to have helped with the fluorescent lettering ECV applied to the back of the plate. Now, Lorenz Knoll is an interesting person. He is the person who ends up talking to one of these historians and telling them about this hoax, and that's his narrative, basically. And then Herbert E. Bolton, who is director of the Bancroft Library from 1920 to 1940, and Sather Professor of American History at UC Berkeley. He was also, like Dane, a member of the California Historical Society and the Clampers. He was fascinated by stories about Drake posting a brass plate to mark his entry into California. He was known for telling his students to be on the lookout for it when in Marin County. The plate's appearance fulfilled Bolton's dream, and he was thrilled to acquire it for the Bancroft. Now, all that information is from the UC Berkeley press release about this. So their theory was that Dane and Barron, Clark and Knoll, all conspired at Dane's instigation to feed this plaque to Bolton. To tweak him as a way to pull a prank on him. But then Bolton bought into it so hard that they couldn't really back out of it. They
And remember, these are not just some guys. These are
no
very connected people.
prominent people.
Exactly. I mean, this is not some garage hoax by some dudes that thought it'd be funny. I mean, there's a museum curator involved. There's, people who are member, who are on the board of the California Historical Society. That tells me that this isn't just some funny thing we decided to do at the bar. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
It
yeah.
seems like, to be blunt, a private psyop, for lack of a better word.
It's definitely completely readable as a psyop. And it worked.
Oh, it absolutely worked. And whether Bolton, and I'm not going to cut, I want you to tell me what you think about whether Bolton was involved intentionally or not. They definitely found a guy that they could tell exactly what he wanted to hear, and he would run with it. But these were people that had an agenda, a really specific agenda, and created this object to further that, and it was successful. But go ahead. I digress.
Yeah, so the idea was that okay. So again, from that press release, the tricksters and most of the hoaxed all belong to the same small world of California history enthusiasts, the researchers said, making a public confession very difficult. Though the tricksters tried to warn Bolton indirectly, he disregarded the warnings. Okay. About a decade after the plate was found, Lorenz Knoll, this is the art dealer and restorer, told Albert Shumate, a San Francisco doctor, California historian, and longtime leader of the California Historical Society and the Clampers, what really happened. He said that they had decided to do this elaborate joke and that it got out of hand. And this was after Dane, Barron, and Clark died, and then Bolton died, and then Noel began telling this story to a wider circle. But Albert Schumat, I think it might be Schumate.
So, in other words, three can keep a secret if two are dead.
Kind of idea.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So in this idea, then the idea is that Bolton was innocent. And you still have preserve his reputation, he's still this incredibly renowned historian, very influential, and it's understandable he was just overly enthusiastic. Okay, so that sounds reasonable, and we realize that Drake, this is not Drake's bait. This is not substantiating Drake's claim to California. However, in what do we have about 2019, again, it's always these women that are coming for Bolton from the Pacific Northwest. There is a historian called Melissa Darby. There is a great article in the Smithsonian called "Did Francis Drake Really Land in California?" New research suggests that one of the state's greatest historians is oh God, excuse me, greatest historians had a hand in perpetrating an infamous hoax. So Melissa Darby is a historian, and she, I have not read her book or looked deeply into her research, but from what I've seen of it, she makes some valid points from multiple angles, which partly she is looking at internal testimony from the guy who wrote about Drake's Plate and what he has to say about like the architecture and the lifestyle of the indigenous peoples where they landed. For example, they have like plank houses here in the Miwok, which would be the territory that Drake's Bay in Point Reyes is in. They have like bark houses. And so it's a different kind of architectural style. And then also she's looking at the words that were used. She links that more to the Pacific Northwest peoples. And she says that some of the other archaeological evidence, like old Chinese ware that was found in a shipwreck here, has been identified as a shipwreck that was actually a Spanish boat. It was not plunder via Drake. There was some evidence that one of Drake's ships had spilled a bunch of this Chinese ware. And that has been documented as having been shipwrecked or dumped here, and then the indigenous people started trading it this like in the 1600s or something. So that's something that's been followed. She said that the archaeological and historical work on that shows that it was a Spanish ship and not Drake. Then I'm quoting from the article here. Darby, Melissa Darby, this historian, details how Bolton was often associated with a host of scams and schemes relating to Spanish or pirate treasure. In 1920, he publicly authenticated a 16th century Spanish map pointing to a rich cache of silver and gold in New Mexico that set off a media frenzy, right? Publicity moon. It proved a fake, but gave Bolton his first taste of national renown. The next year, Bolton claimed to have translated an old document that gave clues to an ancient trove of nearly 9,000 gold bars hidden near Monterrey, Mexico. When he declined a spot in the expedition organized to find it and to share in the profits, he again made headlines by turning down the offer because of his pressing academic duties.
He
No
was
treasure ever
kind of working
surfaced.
the system, playing the game, despite being an incredibly influential academic.
Yes, and she also points out about how these schemes helped him because, you know, a lot of this was happening like in the 30s when it was a Great Depression, and you know, as today, academics need to attract students and you know, sponsorships and get excitement about their programs. So she thinks that
Oh,
he was
yes.
kind of working that a little bit. And then, you know, having this plate in the Bancroft Library is really you know, a big wow.
Oh yes, it's hugely influential. Yeah, and
So
it's a
she
big
makes,
draw. Yeah, people come to see
yeah,
it.
so she makes a decent case that he could have been in on it, and we don't have the type of documents to know. And as you say, you know, with the clampers being so heavily involved, especially, you know, there's this constant muddying of the waters.
Yes, and just everybody who seems to be involved with this is the clamper, and also involved with quote unquote legitimate academic history and archaeology. And that's a real tough thing to reconcile, because they seem to be inserting, for lack of a better term, bullshit into the academic narrative. And that's way easier to put in than it is to pull out.
Yes. And especially when you have, you know, a lot of this is kind of like is sub rosa too,
Oh, very
right?
much so.
Like the Renaissance fair, you're kind of in this kind of altered state, and you're just out there having fun, and so you're a lot going to be a lot less skeptical, or have a lot less
Oh,
barriers
yes.
up to this type of information coming in.
We're not here to do critical thinking. We're here to have a good time.
Exactly. And plus,
And
you know,
that,
there's plenty of booze.
exactly, that could be the Clamper motto, to be very blunt, Stephanie, do you mind if we pause for just a moment?
Oh, not at all.
And thank you. We're back. Let's see. When we broke there for just a moment, Stephanie, you were talking, I believe, about the risks that the professor would have had to take to his credibility if he was involved with this, or whether other people were just feeding him what he wanted to hear. That's what Eugene Bolton. We were kind of discussing whether Herbert Eugene Bolton. We're just kind of discussing whether he was in on it or not in on it. And what is your take on that?
I really could not say one way or the other.
I think that's
And
fair. It's not clear from anything I've picked up whether he was in on it or whether he just bit down hard on exactly what he wanted to hear.
yeah. But oh God, do you mind? I have this, the dog is going crazy.
Oh, no problems, no
Just a
problems.
second. Just, what are you
Sure.
doing? Okay, so Reed Bolton, I really couldn't say one way or the other. Either way, he would be taking a risk to his reputation, but at the same time, like you're saying, he's incredibly influential and well connected, so he was in a much better position to control the narrative. And the fascinating thing is that in October, I believe, of 2012, the Interior Department, I believe it was, of the United States government decreed that yes, Drake's Bay was indeed the site where Francis Drake had landed when he was sailing around.
Wow.
And yes,
And so you have, go ahead,
so it
please.
worked.
Yes, you have something that started out as a hoax, as allegedly as a prank, April Fool's joke. And I would say it started out as fake news. And it becomes so embedded in the narrative that 100 years later, give or take, you have the government saying, no, that's what really happened. And, it became history, even though there was nothing there. It was made up. And it was detected and it was exposed. And like sometimes the story, I'm not saying the lie, but I'm saying the story sometimes has like a force of its own. Like it works, it forces its way into history, even though it's not true.
Yeah, it's like creating facts on the ground. I mean,
Yes.
in the case of the clampers, literally, they place these plaques all over the place.
Yes.
You had an interesting example that I didn't know about the Star of India.
Yes, the Star of India. And I have done some research, but I haven't been able to determine. I believe this is an actual correct piece of information, but as you can tell, it's not always that easy. The Star of India was a ship, and there is a official California State Historical Marker number 1050, which is in San Diego. The Star of India is a ship in the Maritime Museum at San Diego, and it's the earliest iron-hulled sailing ship in existence. It was launched in, I believe, 1853. And I'm certainly not saying the Star of India didn't exist. It appears to be real, and it appears to be fairly well documented, and also much more recent than Sir Francis Drake. This is 1853. We can still kind of nail down what really happened and what didn't. But yet it still promotes the same narrative because it's a very British ship. It's well, the historical marker mentions that it's a three-masted bark, the oldest iron-hulled merchant ship afloat, built on the Isle of Man in Great Britain. And there you go. It's the same narrative. It's stressing the importance of the British history of the American West. And that fits the Clamper narrative that fits what they're into, what their agenda really is. And go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I think that is a good point and a good call. And this is interesting because I'm looking at the picture right now, and it's a California Registered Historical Landmark, which means that it has been vetted by the State Department of Recs and Recreation, State Department of Parks and Recreation, and California, historical process. They have this whole administrative historical process for evaluating the wording, the historical significance, accuracy, all that. So you can see, and it's also in cooperation with the Maritime Museum of San Diego and the Ancient and Honorable Order of E. Clampus Vitus Squibob Chapter, SQIBOB. I have no idea what that's about. That's one of the chapters of ECV. So it's this official thing, but E. Clampus is, like you say, choosing these certain aspects of like official history to emphasize.
Yes, and the Clampers are literally involved. And that just, again and again, you see it, that they're promoting certain, sometimes certain fallacies, but sometimes actual true information. But from a certain perspective. Yeah. And that perspective is always the British and the Anglo-Americans have a full claim to California and the rest of Nevada and the rest of the American West. That's like what their agenda and ideology is. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, I'm going a little afield here, but not that far. In the fake plaque, which we now know to be fake, but still, carries enormous weight, despite being
it did its job,
decades ago, yes. In the plaque, the indigenous people surrender all claim to the land to Britain, the British Empire, and the Queen.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to comment on the events that happened in the 1900s when a Clamper who claimed to be a chief of a tribe
who was able,
who was able to give that dispensation and say, we surrendered everything to the Queen, took it back and gave it to the United States of America?
Yeah, that I can't even, I have no idea.
I think I have something on that here.
I mean, that did happen. I don't know what that person's status was. Part of the thing is that a lot of, let's see, I don't want to say this. So here in California and in many other areas in the United States, if you are an enrolled tribal member or deemed to be a member of a particular tribe that's endorsed by the United States government, you have rights under treaty. So you could have land rights, extractive rights, so on and so forth. If you want to get a nice lesson on this, which is going to completely destroy your faith in humanity, you can read Angie DeBose, History of the Indians in the United States. She talks about in the Midwest how in certain areas, indigenous children and their parents would all have rights to, for example, oil that was being pumped out of the ground, or to mining or whatever. And if a child was found to be orphaned, then white people could adopt that child and then take on those rights. And so people would murder the parents and adopt the children for the.
Oh my God. Yes, I am familiar with what you're speaking of. And yes, it's absolutely brutal.
It just is. It's really just despicable and disgusting. But and it speaks to race in the United States, because it's like, OK, the one drop rule applies to Black racial identity, right? That was the recipe.
It did for many years, yes.
Yes, because why? Because Black people are property. And if you are a white person making laws and you want to hang on to your property, right? Then you want to, you know, it wouldn't be something where you'd want to, let's say, grow a bunch of tomatoes, let's say, and then all the tomatoes, when they become ripe tomatoes, get to leave, right? No, you want them all to be, continue to be tomatoes. This is like the same viewpoint or logic, right? If you have a bunch of cattle, right?
Oh, I see the parallels of what you're saying.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Yes. Right. Now, the problem with Indigenous people, with Native American people, and the whole idea of blood quantum, it works the exact opposite, right? Because if you're you're only, this is a disgusting term, you're only a half breed, right? That's that's because that lineage, or quote blood unquote heritage, entitles you to certain rights legally. So they want to so the powers that be want to discount that, because, you know, if you're a white person writing these laws, you want to get rid of the people who are already there, right? So it makes no sense logically, because, you know, it's like kind of like two different angles at it. But yeah, so that's, you know,
it's what very much a, if something can be taken from you, then we do it one way. If it needs to be kept from you, then we do it a different way.
Yeah.
And
it just has to do with these historical things, which it just goes to show how, like, race is a social construct.
It is completely a social construct.
Yeah.
And we could do a whole separate show on, oh my God, I have so much to say about one dropism and invisible Indians and other things that we're not going to really be able to fully go into here. But yes, there was so much corruption in the writing of these laws. And
there's so many different nations and peoples across the United States, and they all have their own histories and stuff. But anyway, so that reflects, again, this whole idea of the tension between, manifest destiny, like you're saying, and the whole idea of this, the frontier and these Edens. I mean, you know, California's always had this kind of an Eden aspect. I grew up in Cache Valley in Eden Township. Is that right? And the whole idea is that this is completely empty land. It's just beautiful and bountiful, and it's just there for the pioneers and Anglo-European white people to come in and create civilization.
It was a huge, massive myth. And
exactly.
My uncle still lives in Eden, Wisconsin. There's Edens all over the place. Yeah. Oh, don't worry. Eden's only a stone's throw from El Dorado, Wisconsin. So,
yeah, there you go.
Yes, yes. We were creating, I didn't become a co-defendant on this stuff, but the pioneers were creating this huge myth. The whole phrase, the new world, there's nothing new about it. People have been here for 15,000 years minimum.
And the incredible, I mean, like, how much of what everyone eats today was domesticated by the people of the New Worlds, right? You know, potatoes, corns. Yeah, those
huge
are staple.
Shock. Yes, exactly. Yeah. I was shocked. I do come from a Irish background when I learned that we didn't always have potatoes.
That's so right.
We didn't have potatoes until after the, you know, colonization started.
Yeah.
What the hell do we eat before? Wow. Okay. But yes.
A lot of greens. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
And yeah,
maize
so a lot
and all
of,
that. Yeah.
Yes. But so a lot of these, rumors and ideas and stuff have to do with justifying the fact that we're stealing this land. Right. If you look at, for example, the whole idea of Lemuria and Mount Shasta.
Oh, yes, please.
In California. That comes out of a lot of ideas that have to do with the idea that, actually, that was the Atlanteans or the Lemurians who were the advanced white brotherhood that was here actually before the Karuk people who live up in Mount Shasta, right? It's like,
yes, what, it's a constant attempt to get a earlier claim.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
We were here before the Native people were here.
Yeah.
And yes, and it's ongoing. I mean, there's so many of these. And, you know, Ancient Apocalypse, I binge watched it. I loved it. I have to bring that up because people have accused Graham Hancock of promoting those ideas. And he does not say that Atlanteans were white. Well, even white itself is a cultural construct.
Yeah.
You know,
I don't.
And you could have Atlantis without having that, but there's a lot, there's always an infiltration by people that want to perpetrate a certain narrative. Go ahead.
And well, the problem is, here's the problem, that line of thinking always goes back to these old ideas where those ideas started as a way to justify, to say that there was a prior claim before the Native peoples here. And that, you know, that for me, I can't get past that. And in my, I studied archaeology in college, and there's just not the evidence, but the I don't want to say the objections that people like Hancock bring against archaeology as it is practiced, that don't hold water in from whatever I've been able to see. And the roots of that thinking are too problematic for me. And so I mean, the idea that aliens, I don't know, may have helped us along. I don't know about that. And
that I don't dismiss, but that's just my opinion. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't, who knows? But to me, I have looked at those ideas for too long and in too much of depth, and also looked at the academic work, and it's just too inherently racist for me I can't abide it.
And I guess I would respectfully disagree, only for the simple reason that I'm involved in some, I have some interests that are constantly infiltrated. I look at it like this. If you like guns, and I don't want to digress too far into politics, but
yeah,
if you like guns, you will have racist people, like, for lack, to be blunt, crawling up your ass to sell you their theory of, oh, I like guns too. You know why we need guns. And one thing leads to another.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean if you like guns, you're racist. It doesn't mean that. But there is a constant infiltration. And if you're interested in possible pre-Ice Age civilizations, people are there to infiltrate. And are there to, you know, sell their ultimately racist ideology just because you're interested in this other thing that has nothing to do with that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, you're very right to be constantly on your guard, because a lot of these ideas, I mean, there's a lot of, there's just a lot of authoritarian racist ideas out there. And then a lot of history is authoritarian and racist. And a lot of these oppressive threads. So yeah, I mean, you're right. You have to be alert and on your guard.
Absolutely. A lot of people are selling things, and that's the tip of the iceberg. And what they really want to sell you is just some Nazi crap, but they want to get you with a hook, you know, that will seem normal, you know?
Yeah. And I do appreciate, I mean, the whole idea of, you know, human origins and how we used to live and all the things that people have been up to is one of the most incredibly fascinating things that you can study and look into. So I really can't fault people from that angle. But I think, like you say, it's important to look at. Well, I like this Clamper discussion. I think is really interesting because there's a lot of stuff that you just kind of see is kind of background noise in a lot of ways, but there are people behind it who are pushing a certain agenda
Oh, absolutely.
consistently. So I think that this applies there as well as just. Do your best to kind of step back and think about, okay, what's this? Who are these people? What are they saying? What's it about?
Absolutely. Your critical thinking is just a must in dealing with this stuff. And I did find the note of what I was talking about with the man who was the chief of the Miwoks in 1937, William Fuller, was a member of E. Clampus Vetus. And he, re during a ECV meeting, he revoked the cession of land to England and ceded it all to the United States. And
Convenient.
yes, exactly. And it's purely this performative thing that just builds that there's, a Anglo-American claim to the West. And that's what we've found so far. And I hope that listeners may come forward with some more Clamper material, because that would be very helpful. That's what we've found so far, that there is an agenda that's driving this thing. And this is not just blue-collar miners hanging out and having a few drinks. This is way more connected than that. And I don't think the story's done.
No. And I think we had to have
Not in the least,
a one or two tension headaches trying to
Yes. It
because I thought, well, the Drake's hoax, that's interesting, and it's all kind of done and dusted and every and then I started looking into it, it's like what? It's like still controversial.
When you hit me with in 2012, the feds said, oh no, this is real. And anybody who looks at it can tell that no, it's not real. It's been exposed. It was exposed 40 years ago. But I believe there's some political forces that want it to be true. So we'll just say it's true, And that carries a lot of weight, That carries a lot of weight in the world.
It's just fascinating. And that we didn't even touch on there's a whole love of E. Clampus Vetus for let's say, well, oh, as you're saying, ladies of the evening, various outlaws, and a lot of stuff about like kind of airships and possible UFO sightings. Just kind of all these tips of the hat to the extraterrestrial. There was one in Alum Rock Park, I think. They had a plaque, and they talked about all this stuff. It used to be like a tourist trap, and they had a carousel there and this and that and the other thing, and then they talked about how it used to be the site of a it was supposed to be thought to be the site of an extraterrestrial meteor, but then it turned out it was a natural formation. It's like, so that's the type of thing that got me when I was a kid. You're reading all this stuff and you're like, but meteors, all meteors are extraterrestrial, so why did they put extraterrestrial? It's
By
like they just kind of
definition,
put
they don't come from Michigan. They come from outer space. Yes.
But so they're, but they're just kind of putting it, they're just kind of like nudging you
Yes.
towards, and then they have
I
like
think you
a,
know what we mean. Yes.
yes. And then there's one in Livermore, which is fun talking about the Tolliver airship. 8 miles, I'm reading from the plaque, 8 miles southwest of this location in the spring of 1904, Charles Tolliver built an airship with an aluminum superstructure covered with 6,000 yards of pongee silk. The craft was to be 250 feet long, 48 feet wide, and 44 feet high. Blah, blah, blah. It was funded by Phoebe Hearst again. There were several ground accidents, and the craft never flew. This was dedicated in 1981. But again, this whole idea that like a Delshow and the airships
Yes,
and
I
call
was going to
back
bring
in
it up if you didn't. Go ahead.
to the airship waves of 1897, which happened in California. And actually, I found out many years ago, I lived for a few years with a friend of mine on Broadway in Oakland, and it was just like two or three blocks from where one of those airships had been sighted.
Wow.
I know. I was like, what the heck? Anyway.
I am fascinated with the airship wave there because it hits that right at that area where it could be physically literally true. Like yeah. as true as the pickup truck that's sitting in front of my house. Or it could be UFO phenomena. Bullshit.
Yeah.
Or it could be made up. Yes, it could be completely fictional. Or all of those could be true at the same time in different circumstances. It's
yeah.
Really, so, it's a fascinating thing. Please go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, but anyway, so I was just going to say that there's this whole kind of like very playful side to Eclampus, but it again is talking about like advanced technology and this whole idea of keep tipping the hat to contact with well, it's like a kind of a callback to Drake, right? You have like the exploring new lands or you know contact with new horizons. It's the whole idea of like space travel and everything, and the extraterrestrial landing legends of the West. So yeah, I think that could be an interesting angle to look at too. But like you're saying, I don't think anywhere that there's been any kind of a decent history or grappling with the Clampers. And I was always trying to convey to people, because they're like, oh, it's just kind of like the Masons or the Elks. It's like, no, not really.
No, it's way more influential than that. But there's still this huge outer section that's just, like I said, bikers without motorcycles, you know?
Yeah, a bunch of like drunk horn dogs.
Yes,
in landscape. Know?
And you raised an interesting point, which I didn't really follow up on that much. But in the frontier, there was, and I see this as kind of a positive thing. Mm-hmm. There was, because of necessity, a lifting of a lot of the really judgmental norms.
Yeah.
And, you know, the women who came there, they weren't really coming there to be seamstresses, you know.
Yeah.
They're mostly sex workers.
Yeah.
But they were seen in a much more benevolent, equitable way than they would have been seen back east.
Yeah, there'd be a time, you know, like during these gold rushes and stuff, where there was a lot greater social mobility and more, like you're saying, not the kind of rigid social structures and strata that were very much, of course, at that time, even more so than today. So, yeah, so it's a very interesting, technically you would call that like a liminal time, right?
It was very liminal. And
yeah.
Just to make a pop culture reference that you may pick up on, and no, you ever watch Gunsmoke?
Not for a million years.
Okay. It comes on. I love black and white TV and movies. Yeah. And okay, when I say Miss Kitty,
yes,
like it's just kind of accepted that Miss Kitty, well, what does she do for a living? I mean, she's not really a bar owner. She's a madam, but that's yeah. Somehow like okay in 1950s America. It's never spoken of, but if you have any historical knowledge at all, it's pretty obvious, you know,
yeah.
That's what she does and that's how things work. And that's the world that was. And even though, I mean, of course, it's not any kind of accurate depiction, but that's always stuck with me as nobody ever questions that. Like, well, who is that? You know? And how is she so cool with Marshall Dillon? What the hell? You
know? Yep.
And that wasn't, that specific part wasn't a great departure from reality. And that's kind of where the Clampers were coming from at that era.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So I just should note briefly that for what it's worth, synchronistically or not, we're recording this on Mardi Gras. And I have to give credit where credit's due. I wouldn't know about this stuff if it wasn't for the guys from Conspiranormal doing some work on the Mardi Gras cruise and how much went on behind the scenes there. And that really reminded me of the Clampers. And I'll keep it brief, because we could do a whole other show on that. But when you think of Mardi Gras, you just think of kind of a wild party and parades and music and beads and a lot of drinking. That's what I think of. But the Mardi Gras crews actually were led by a bunch of very powerful people. And there was a lot of politics behind the scenes, and it was really a tool of social control. And there's a lot, that's something we're going to have to address at a different time, but that really did impress me that this is a lot like the Clampers. It seems lighthearted. It seems just a good time, you know, hang out, have a bunch of drinks, nothing serious here, nothing to get too interested in. Don't follow up on anything. But behind the scenes, there's a lot of very serious things going on. And there's definitely an agenda. And that's kind of what I see, a very similarity there.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting with the Clampers because they have all these individual chapters. And even just if you look at the plaques that they've sponsored and their websites, you can see that the individual chapters have a particular orientation. So, and I think this is the same with like a lot of fraternal organizations and lodges and stuff, or, you know, any type of a human group. I think that there's kind of like the overall themes, and then some of them seem a little bit more, you know, for fun and rowdy. But
oh, yes, are some people who just totally do this for the enjoyment,
Yeah, and then there's certain other ones that are really into the history and really have that kind of laser focus on the agenda that they want to get across. So it's interesting. Okay, I have to say that Oliver is being a complete brat and driving everyone crazy. And I think I'm going to have to wind it up.
Oh, yes. Well, we've only been talking about this for 2 hours. So, you know.
And we barely scratched the surface. Hopefully, we've at least explained kind of the whole Drake's hoax.
Yes. I hope people can, you know, feel free to comment and to send to this podcast anything that you've got. Personal experience, historical research. I'm wide open to hearing what you have to say, because this is a fascinating topic. And as you said, we've just scratched the surface. We've given one good example, but that's it.
Oh, man. It is just, yeah. And the material that's out there is very scattered here and there, and it changes depending on, well, just with the hoax, it's like, well, if you could take a snapshot in the 60s, one thing, 1980, something completely different, 2003, oh, yeah, now we have. And then, you know, even up till today, it's like, well, guess what? It's crazy. And it's a lot to keep track of, but it's fascinating, too.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, hey, I'd like to thank you, Stephanie, for spending this couple hours talking about something that is fairly obscure, but is important and is really interesting. And thank you for your time and for your insights and information. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no, thank you. Because this is, you know, it's something that's been tantalizing, you know, a group that I was fascinated from the time I was very small. So it's really great to have the opportunity to dig in further with someone, especially like you, that really gets it and the fascination. So yeah, I would be super excited if we smoke anyone else out who might be interested in talking about any of this stuff, because I think that there's a definite, well, like you say, the conspiranormal guys definitely have that viewpoint of looking at some of these more underground streams of influence in society, I guess, that like recluse on the farm, those other
absolutely.
People. So hopefully they'll enjoy it and get inspired to poke around too. So,
yes. And I hope that we can come back, have you back on again.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll probably have more to say.
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty much a certainty, if I may.
Yeah. No, I would love to. I think it'd be fun, but have to have some time to dig in some more. But yeah,
Oh,
definitely I'll be
yes.
up for
Oh, yes.
revisiting this. Be a lot of fun.
Well, thank you very much. And folks, thanks for listening. This has been The Weird Part. I am your host, Vincent Trewell. Stephanie Quick has been my very special guest tonight. Thank you and good night.